We're discussing big tech and whether our country needs to revise laws regulating social media after the violent insurrection at the Capitol. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Social media platforms can be a venue for hate speech, for bullying, and worse, dangerous groups use these platforms to misinform, to gin up conspiracy theories, and to plan attacks like the deadly one on our Capitol. Have you seen talk of violence online? Have you ever tried to report it, to stop it? What laws would you support governing speech online? 800-642-1234 to join in. Shannon McGregor is an assistant professor at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media and a senior researcher with the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Shannon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me, and good morning.
Good morning. The events of January 6th, it brought a ton of traffic and attention to parts of the internet that aren't top of mind when we think social media, like Parler and Gab, but it wasn't just fringe sites. It was the high-profile ones, too. Can you explain for us what planning was done on social media and the role it had on the January 6th attack?
Yeah, social media was really integral in the organization of this event that then turned into an attack. And as you said, some of it happened on, you know, smaller or more fringe sites, but lots of it happened out in the open on sites that lots of people are on, like Twitter, and even more so on Facebook. There was a report yesterday that came out that showed how many Facebook groups, you know, people were being pushed to these political Facebook groups that, you know, even though they took down Stop the Steal, had, you know, Win the Win in them and were really used for planning this event on January 6th.
Do you think that the niche platforms that have provided safe haven for extremist movements, will they be coming under increased scrutiny from now on? And if so, by whom?
I do think that we might see this, you know, one of the things that there is bipartisan agreement on, which there's not many, but one of them is that the tech companies need some type of regulation. I think, you know, the Republican and Democratic parties have really different ideas about what that might look like and how it might come about. But I do think with the incoming Biden administration, we're likely to see some type of regulation. You know, what that exactly looks like, I think it's going to be hard to tell, but it's clear that we need some type of regulation around speech that incites violence, that does run rampant on some of these platforms.
Silicon Valley's power, as you're saying, has become a concern of Congress. You see it in the antitrust lawsuits filed by dozens of state attorneys general and the Justice Department. There is this power struggle going on, and social media platforms, they wield power. How do you see this playing out in government regulation and policy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that it comes down to the decision of one person, Jack Dorsey, you know, running Twitter to take the president basically offline. Whether or not you agree with that decision, I think everyone agrees that that sets a dangerous precedent. And so the type of regulation that we might see is around, you know, what sort of protections are in place for political figures on these sites? You know, do they need to be broken up so that one decision doesn't affect someone across three or four of these platforms, like we might see in the case with Facebook, which also owns Instagram and which also owns WhatsApp, which when you combine those three represents billions of people on these platforms and millions within the US. And so there might be some type of regulation in the protections that these tech platforms have right now. And there also might be some type of regulation in terms of what sort of speech is prioritized on these platforms. But as of right now, they're private platforms and they can, you know, make decisions about the type of speech that they would like to host and the type of speech that they would not like to host, which is what we've seen really, I think, around the 2020 election.
You know, the researchers and the academics who, like you, closely monitor and parse the rhetoric on these sites have said that the exchanges on these platforms have always been extreme. The language is always intense, but this overheated rhetoric doesn't necessarily translate to outright violence. And then that all changed on January 6th. Were you surprised?
I don't think anyone was surprised by this. It was shocking, but not surprising, as I think the sort of view that I've settled on. You know, for years, basically, leading up to 2020. So in the wake of 2016 and sort of the, you know, revelations of fake news and Russian interference, Facebook made a decision to deprioritize news and prioritize groups. They thought this would connect people with more regular people, and that's what people wanted on Facebook. But what we saw was while some of these groups were for cancer survivors or for people who like knitting or cooking, some of them were really about extreme views. We saw QAnon flourish on there, for example. And what we know across many social media platforms is that what gets engagement is more extreme posts. And then once something gets engagement, then it gets more engagement. And so it really does help encourage an extremity of views.
We're talking with Shannon McGregor, an expert in social media and its effects on politics, discussing how the violent insurrection was planned online and where we go from here. You can join in. Have you seen talk of violence online? How have you tried to quell it? Have you reported it? Do you have a family member or friend who believes in conspiracy theories online? What do you say? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now. Marcus is with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Marcus. What would you like to add?
Good morning. So I feel like we need to go to the Bible for this, and it says nothing's new under the sun. We've always had this type of smearing in type of negative rhetoric that's out there. I mean, going back to the Federalist Papers with our founding fathers, bringing it forward, you know, I think it's a slippery slope if we start regulating this. However, on the other side, I feel like it's a tech company, and if, you know, albeit a very large tech company or whatever, if they want to take and pull the platform for people's, you know, rhetoric or whatever they want to talk about, I think that's fully within their rights because, you know, they're not obligated to broadcast speech that is against what they believe. And so, while yes, I'm not necessarily for, you know, like having tech companies decide because they do control media to how much of the world, you know, but it's like, I also do feel like it's their right, just like if, you know, you guys aren't required to broadcast hate speech, you know?
Marcus, thank you for that. You know, Marcus brings up deplatforming and, you know, that this is a slippery slope, Shannon.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Marcus makes a great point. These are private companies and they are allowed to make whatever decisions they would like about the speech that's on their platform. You know, they do not need to host hate speech. What I think is concerning is, you know, as you know, we already have such a fractured media environment and indeed a fractured social environment. And what, you know, one of the worries about deplatforming of some of these more extreme views is good, but does it drive people to a place where they're even less likely to engage with people who have different views with them or even with reality, you know, and does that further deepen sort of the divides that we see in this country?
Yeah, I wonder, do you think there will always be a way for extremist voices, whether it is QAnon, whether it is white supremacists or Proud Boys or whomever, to keep communicating, to making their views known and finding each other on the internet?
I mean, yes, absolutely. And, you know, although, of course, I think social media is important, that's why I research it. I just want to point out this is not a social media problem, right? This is the problem. We see white supremacist views broadcast on cable news networks. You know, we see them coming out of some of the highest, you know, offices in this nation. And so while social media has certainly played a role in exacerbating these views, potentially in spreading them to more people, this is a society-wide problem. You know, one of my colleagues said yesterday in panel, and I think it's the right idea. If we don't agree with these views, and if we want them to not be a part of our society, if we want to say white supremacy is wrong, then people with these views need to be sort of widely shunned, right? And that's on social media, but it's sort of more broadly. It's not just a social media problem.
Yeah, you have to broaden out and look holistically at the problem. Let's go to Steve now in Sun Prairie. Steve, hi, what would you like to bring here?
Yeah, I get a little angry about some of this conversation. There's hateful rhetoric across the board. We saw months upon months upon months of hateful rhetoric coming from so-called Black Lives Matter people online in the news with lies upon lies upon lies. We've had seizures of cities. We've had buildings burnt down. We've had intimidation, which is domestic violence. And yet the only thing we talk about is a minority of people that are white supremacists. Even last night on NPR, they had an extremist Black Lives Matter group, I believe it was called the People's Movement. And yet we don't talk about that. And we just talk about this minority of groups that is universally condemned by all. When are we
let's Shannon jump in here with her thoughts. Go ahead, Shannon.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to realize that there are extreme views on both sides, but they don't have the same consequences. Only people who supported one political party stormed the Capitol and tried to interfere in our democratic process. You know, and I think what's most important to uphold, whether you're from the right or you're from the left, is the idea that we're in a democracy and that everyone's votes count and everyone's voices should be heard as long as they are upholding democratic principles. And I think that's what has to undergird our discussion around what sort of speech and what sort of political actions we support is whether it's democratic or not.
Let's bring in Michael now in Bear Valley. Michael, hi.
Hello. I just have a question about media literacy. I think one of the problems I see is that a lot of these extremist groups are thriving on lies and misinformation. And I'm wondering why media literacy isn't a part of the standard curriculum, especially in high school. Madison has a very illustrative history in media literacy projects. And I was just wondering why some of these projects aren't integrated into the curriculums in high school.
Michael, thank you. Shannon, media literacy, are we behind?
Media literacy should definitely be an important part of it. You know, I have a 9-year-old, and since he's been in first grade, they've been talking, you know, in his classes around how to judge information, you know, that they find on the internet and things like that. I do think media literacy is an important part of it, but it's not going to solve everything. You know, all the correct information in the world could not have stopped what happened on January 6th. Disinformation and misinformation is a tool that exacerbates extreme ideas, that deepens the divisions that already exist in our country. So I think any type of media literacy has to be, on the one hand, about, you know, the judging the veracity of information, and that's an important part of it. But another part of media literacy is understanding the sort of deep divisions and white supremacist history of this country so that you can judge information with that sort of critical eye from both perspectives.
Shannon McGregor, an assistant professor and senior researcher at the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We're discussing how to regulate social media. Where do we go from here? How should the government address the power of big tech? Does a shift to more insular spaces like Telegram and Gab raise the risk of conspiracy theories and radicalization? How do you want local law enforcement to track down or break up the plotting of violence online? 800-642-1234 to join in. Back in a minute with Shannon McGregor here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the role of social media in the violent insurrection on the Capitol and how to govern speech online. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The plans to storm the Capitol unfolded on sites like Facebook, on Twitter, on fringe social media sites long before the attack happened. Critics say social media companies, to a certain extent, permitted talk of the violence to persist without cracking down enough and bear some responsibility. Should platforms be held legally responsible for the riot? Should tech companies share some of the blame? Join in 800-642-1234. Shannon McGregor is with the Center for Information Technology and Public Life at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and she's with us for 10 more minutes. We heard from Kathy in Milwaukee, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Kathy wants to know, Shannon, if the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, could crack down more on networks for spreading false information online. Kathy asks, what is the role of the FCC?
The role of the FCC depends on whether we consider platforms to be media or not, you know, and they have long resisted this idea that they play any role, that they are media platforms, and that they make editorial decisions. I think one of the silver linings of all of this around 2020 and around the six as well is that it is so clear now that these platforms are media companies, that they are making editorial decisions about, you know, things that really do impact our public sphere and impact our politics. And so that then makes it more likely that some of these regulatory bodies can come in and play a role. This would not be new. It would probably have to be around paid speech in the way that political advertisements are regulated through TV, for example. But there is a role to play if we can agree that these platforms are indeed media companies that make editorial decisions.
So when Twitter erases tens of thousands of accounts affiliated with QAnon following the Capitol breach, this is reactive. This is a reactive approach. You know, banning you on Twitter after years of abusive and hateful language, that's after it's happened. Is the current approach to combating disinformation or extremism, is this working in a reactive way?
It's absolutely reactive. And I think that's one of the things that's been most frustrating as a researcher to watch, and as I'm sure it's been frustrating for just many regular people to watch, right? Because it's no surprise, right? As I said, the events on 1/6 were shocking, but absolutely not surprising. You know, in the extremity of some of the views are not surprising. And we only see these companies acting in these really reactive ways once the harm is already done. If instead they had principles that undergirded these policies that were around supporting democracy, we might see them be more proactive and not necessarily having the speech flourish and cause harm before it's taken down. And I hope that's what we see going forward.
Shannon McGregor researches social media, how it impacts political processes. We're understanding social media's role in the Capitol insurrection and how tech companies are responding. With your questions and insights, 800-642-1234 to join in the conversation. Let's bring in Brady now in Madison. Hi, Brady. What would you like to say?
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call and creating such a wonderful conversation today. I just wanted to broach a question through a comment. I'm a member of the liquor industry, and so we have a three supplier tiered system that really protects consumers and it aids the government in enforcing regulation. And as the whole liquor industry, liquor stores, distributors, and liquor suppliers, we're regulated by ourselves by an industry called DISCUS, and it's a board of our own lawyers that keep us accountable to our own marketing practices and sales practices. And so they keep us from doing things like advertising to kids intentionally or paying off accounts or price control on the shelf. And the reason that we regulate ourselves is because the United States government isn't prepared resources to stay modern on technology, keep up with us. And so they monitor us monitoring ourselves in order to allow us to be effective and stay nimble as an industry. And I was wondering if you, as such an expert, and thank you for sharing your time with us today and helping us with this conundrum, if you thought maybe that could be a system that might be viable or might be beneficial. I'll take my comments off air.
Yeah, thank
you. So much. I hope everyone's feeling.
Yeah, thank you, Brady. Shannon, go ahead. You know, just having a board of your own lawyers keeping this industry accountable.
I mean, I think it's a middle ground, right? That might be part of the solution to the issue, you know, and it was interesting. Thanks, Brady, for sort of talking about that. I didn't know that that's how it was sort of regulated. Obviously, it's outside my area of expertise. But I think, you know, in general, self-regulation in our country, at least, has never worked all the way. But it certainly is part of the solution, right? One of the problems, though, is, and as I think you all pointed out at the sort of lead to the show, is that there's so few companies at the center of this, right? And so they still wield so much power, and how that might be distributed in this sort of, industry-wide, it's not as many organizations coming into the industry. We see Facebook, Google, and Twitter, to a lesser extent, playing such a huge role in this that I would worry about the power inequities there in terms of governing it with a democratic end.
So we saw the social media company Parler taken offline following the breach and then slowly creeping back online. The decision had been made by Amazon, Google, and Apple to take it offline. But you know, now it is partially back. How is this happening?
From the reporting I've read, it is supported by companies based in Russia and not the Amazon Web Services that there used to be. And so that's probably worrying from a national security perspective, although that's not my own area of expertise. But, you know, I think what Parler points to is really this idea, and we've seen this on other sites as well, that when there is very little moderation and very little policy around what type of speech is not only allowed but encouraged, that views tend to get incredibly extreme quite quickly. You know, there's this sort of snowball to extremity on sites that don't have any moderation policies. And frankly, I don't think that's what most people want when they're logging on to a social media site, right? They're not looking for violent rhetoric. But as we saw on January 6th, it doesn't take, you know, it doesn't have to be everyone, right? It can be one very extreme group taking action that have these devastating consequences for people's lives.
So is there a threat then for these platforms to find internet companies to host them who are, for lack of a better word, sympathetic to their cause, to their views?
Yeah, there is, right? Because, you know, this is why we saw Amazon and similarly, we saw, you know, the Google App Store and the Apple App Store take Parler down, because they decided not only did they not want to be potentially legally liable, but they didn't want to support this extreme speech and they didn't want to be a haven for violent and hateful rhetoric. And so if you're saying that you do support Parler and you're putting it back online, then you're basically saying we support violent rhetoric and we're okay with that being a consequence of having little or no moderation. And I think that's really worrisome. Again, when we think about it from a democratic standpoint, disagreement, fine. Inciting violence, not fine.
So let me ask you this, since Trump has been taken out of Twitter and other realms of social media, have we seen yet a decline in disinformation and misinformation?
You know, there's been one study that has said that they have seen a decline in misinformation because of that, but the methods on that were not quite clear. So, I'll wait for more research to support that claim. But what I think we have seen is less misinformation coming from the president, right? Twitter was his pipeline to the news and thus to many more millions of people than follow him on Twitter or even on Twitter. And what we know is that speech that comes from people who are powerful, and, you know, in our country, almost no one is more powerful than the president, has such a greater impact than a tweet that I might send or you might send. And so in deplatforming, you know, one of the most powerful people in our country, who was spreading disinformation, we can certainly see that alone making a huge impact in the extent to which people are exposed to this type of dangerous mis and disinformation.
Okay, we only have, you know, 30 seconds or so left. As you look at President-elect, soon to be President Joe Biden, what do you expect to see from his social media presence and what this administration will do with online platforms?
I certainly expect incoming President Biden's Twitter account to be not quite as exciting as our outgoing president's, right? But, you know, like Twitter was a pipeline for Trump to get in the news, you know, we have no reason to suspect that an incoming President Biden won't use Twitter as sort of a press release in the same way. It's a place where politicians can get their views and their words out relatively unencumbered. You know, it's not a press conference where journalists are asking questions. It's not an interview where a journalist is pushing back. It's a place where you can get your speech out there that's not going to be questioned directly. And that's a great power that a president or any other politician can wield. And they prefer that, of course. So I think there's no reason to suspect that the Biden camp won't use that in the same way. I don't think we're likely to see the sort of excitement, though, that leads journalists to cover it quite so breathlessly.
Shannon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Shannon McGregor is an assistant professor at the Hussman School of Journalism and Media at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Ahead this hour, we look at vaccination rates across the country and see how Wisconsin compares. We'll talk more after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kant. Thanks for being here. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about family politics for today's presidential inauguration.
Believe it or not, not everyone agrees when it comes to politics. And in the current political climate, those differences are especially amplified when trying to have these discussions with family. Waukesha writer Judy Bridges walks us through the complex arc of navigating politics and finding common ground with her distant brother.
My brother lives 3,000 miles away from me in Alaska, where he built a successful business while his wife raised her children. Brother and I were close as kids, not so close during the middle, busy years, and now good friends again, except for politics, where he is the great white hunter and I'm the bra burner. I never actually burned a bra, and he doesn't hunt anymore. Still, we are far left, far right, the difference that's torn so many friends and families apart. Especially now, when smart, decent people are convinced of opposing sets of facts. Our whole country is lined up on one side or the other, and the sides are more likely to spit at each other than talk over the fence. Like it or not, we need to find paths we can walk together. It's clear that we aren't going to argue this out. I can't convince my brother of my thinking, and he can't convince me of his. All that happens when we try is that we back each other into corners we aren't going to come out of. The issues are too hot, our convictions too ingrained. The best we can do is just be together. Earlier this year, my brother asked for my opinions. He said everyone in his circle thinks the way he does. He knows I think differently, and he respects me enough to ask the questions. We tried, both of us. We knew that once upon a time we could talk and come to consensus. Not anymore. Our language had become loaded. Sentences we thought were neutral were unwitting attempts to convince. We swore off politics. Conversations became thinner and less frequent. One day I found a photo of us taken when we were kids, and our biggest disagreement was who beat who in a bike race. I posted the pic on Facebook with this caption: "The love we share is deeper than the distance between us." This photo was taken the year after my mom married his dad, and we got each other in the bargain. Politically, we're miles apart, but we'd each take a bullet for the other. The posting opened the door again, for a while. Then silence. I sent him a note. "Let's not let politics stand in the way of love. How about we connect at least once a week?" He agreed. Now our conversations go something like this. Me: "I'm brewing a pot of bean soup today, the kind you like." Bro: "I'd love to have a bowl of that. It's 9 degrees up here." That's it. Plus updates on his antique autos and my book sales. Will we switch sides? Probably not. But we have cleared a path we can walk together. There is kindness, there is love, there is hope, and a big bubbling pot of bean soup.
Judy Bridges is an author and educator based in Waukesha. The music in this story is by R. Boyd and Dusk. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Just a heads up on our coverage plans for today's inauguration, as Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be sworn in as the next president and vice president of the U.S. Join us for live NPR coverage from the U.S. Capitol starting at 10. That's live inauguration coverage this morning at 10 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, we're looking at COVID vaccine rollout and the supporting data. The Dakotas and West Virginia lead the nation administering the highest percentage of COVID vaccines received per capita. That's from the CDC's data tracker. Wisconsin is toward the bottom. Are you monitoring Wisconsin's statistics on vaccine distribution? What do you see? What do you want clarification on? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText, a collaborative reporting project of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Will, welcome back.
Thanks, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. You now have been knee-deep in vaccine data. Is that right?
That's right. It's all data all year, it seems.
And just when you figure out the data, the state data, you look over to the CDC and you see different data, I understand, on these vaccination numbers. What's going on?
That is true. Well, we learned just yesterday that the federal government allocated an additional 172,150 vaccine doses to Wisconsin. So that brings the state up to a total of almost 780,000 doses of vaccine allocated to the state since mid-December. And that number is pretty set in stone. But where the data gets kind of tricky and where it often differs between the state and the CDC and other outlets that are tracking all of this is in the number of doses that have been actually distributed to the state. So shipped from manufacturers through federal facilities to Wisconsin and then on to vaccinators. And then especially where the data tends to differ quite a bit and where people are tracking it really closely is in the number of doses that are actually administered. So the number of shots that are getting into arms.
So we have to really pay attention to this language, whether it's allocation, distribution, administered or administration, because there can be a lot of different meaning here.
Exactly. And, you know, it can get really confusing, like even just the difference in how the CDC and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services label the doses that are distributed. So the CDC calls them distributed. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services previously called those doses delivered. They now have split that kind of category into two subcategories where they now label doses that are ordered by vaccinators in the state and doses that are in transit. So it takes several days often for doses, once they're ordered, to make their way from the manufacturers to the vaccinators on site. And that kind of time where doses are in limbo, in transit, led to some confusion as well in terms of what is the actual number of doses that are in Wisconsin.
Well, it's led to anger as well. Governor Evers has called out the federal government for not saying the number of vaccines that would be available. What is happening?
Right. So that, yeah, I think Governor Evers called a slap in the face last week when we got word that the outgoing Trump administration had promised to release all of these doses that were believed to have been held back in reserve. And those were doses that were reserved for second doses for folks, because we know that both the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines require two doses. But then we found out just days later that actually that reserve had already pretty much been depleted weeks prior to that. And so there really wasn't any reserve to draw upon.
So when I look at your Wisconsin graph plots, you show a slow kind of smooth upward movement of total COVID doses administered, nothing spiky, nothing really urgent in these trend lines. What is going on in terms of these doses getting into arms?
Yeah, so, and that's one of the things, just a couple days ago, Governor Evers joined several other Midwestern governors and sending a letter to the Trump administration, even requesting the ability for states to order their own doses directly from manufacturers and to kind of sidestep the federal government, which is right now responsible for that. And that's because the number of doses that are being allocated and distributed week to week, while they had been growing from the really kind of small numbers we were seeing initially in mid-December, at least in terms of the number that has been allocated, that's kind of plateaued now. So the additional 172,000 doses that were allocated to Wisconsin this week is actually lower by about 15,000 doses than the number that were allocated the week prior. So in terms of the number of shots that are actually getting into people's arms in Wisconsin, that does appear to be growing slowly week to week. But if the allocations don't start growing considerably, that's going to plateau as well. And at the current rate that we're vaccinating in Wisconsin, we're not going to get to even vaccinating 80% of the population until a year from now.
Yeah, I mean, the goal, I thought, was fall 2021 to have 70% of Wisconsin vaccinated. Is that timetable realistic?
We'll see. As the Department of Health Services and a couple of media briefings lately has really emphasized that allocation and distribution needs to speed up in order for the administration of shots to speed up by as much as two or three times. So we need to be getting two or three times as many shots in people's arms every single day than we are right now in order to meet that goal of having about 70% of the population vaccinated by the end of the summer.
We're talking about vaccine distribution, the numbers, what Will Cushman from WisConText sees with your questions as well. What do you want to know about the data? Are you feeling confused by the numbers and the allocations? In what ways are you hoping to get clarification? Are you monitoring Wisconsin statistics on vaccine distribution? What have you noticed? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Saul now in Stevens Point. Hi, Saul.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
These numbers, no matter how you cut it, really don't add up. We've had at least a month now to distribute. As I understand it, we have 470,000 doses a month currently. We have administered a total of 213,000 vaccinations per month. And in the article I read in the State Journal, they want to go to 1.4 million doses vaccinations per month to get herd immunity by the end of June. How on earth, with this slow, slow vaccination schedule, are they going to meet, you know, even if they get all that vaccine, how are they going to do it?
Saul, thank you for that. A huge scale up, Saul is pointing out. How is that possible?
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Well, and just the numbers that Saul cited there are... It's interesting to me to hear him cite. It sounds like I think he was citing the CDC number, which the CDC right now is showing about 213,000 doses administered in the state. And actually, Wisconsin DHS is showing right now 248,000 doses having been administered as of yesterday. So that's a difference of about 30 some thousand. It's not a huge difference in the grand scheme of things with more than 5 million people in the state. But it's a little bit higher than that. But yeah, it's definitely going to take a lot more speed in terms of getting shots in arms. And I know that the rollout started fairly slowly, and state health officials kind of warned folks that it would start slowly. They started out with only a few dozen vaccinators registered in the state in mid-December. That number has grown now to about 1,200 registered vaccinators. So this is everything from local health departments to pharmacies to healthcare providers and other settings that are now registered to be able to provide to vaccinate people against COVID-19. And I think that the other hope, in addition to just more vaccinators being online and putting shots in arms, the other hope is that there will be more vaccines coming online in the next weeks and months. There's a vaccine from Johnson & Johnson that's hopefully will be approved soon. There's another one from AstraZeneca. And the really kind of nice thing about the Johnson & Johnson one is that would be a one-shot vaccine, so people wouldn't have to go back for a second dose. So hopefully, as more vaccines come online, things will get quicker. But yeah, as Saul said, I don't know if June is going to be interesting to see if we can make it there.
We're talking with Will Cushman, journalist with WisconText. He's been digging into the COVID vaccine rollout data, what the trend lines show, what they indicate, what level of detail should the state disclose on the vaccine campaign. How do you think Wisconsin's vaccine distribution compares to other states? What are other states doing that you want Wisconsin to follow? Are you eligible to receive a vaccine, but you haven't been able to get it yet? What's causing the delay? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Will Cushman on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about vaccine rollout. Health officials are racing to inoculate people. Some states are more successful than others, as we've seen. North Dakota has one of the best vaccination rates in the country, according to the CDC tracker. States like Alabama and Georgia are at the bottom. Wisconsin toward the bottom. Nearly 13.6 million Americans now have received their initial vaccine dose as of yesterday morning. That's the latest data published by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So relative to other states, how do you think Wisconsin is doing? What do you think is holding up distribution? 800-642-1234 to join in. Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText, and he's our guide to vaccination data. So, Will, as you look at this data on vaccine distributions and these comparisons, is it fair to compare Wisconsin's rollout with other states?
That's a really good question, and it's kind of a complicated question. And I want to clarify that Wisconsin right now seems to be a little bit behind middle of the pack among the states, maybe about in 28th place in terms of the percent of its population that has received a first dose. But as I was just mentioning, it's kind of hard to make those comparisons, A, because the data is just changing so quickly. People are being vaccinated very quickly. These numbers are changing hour to hour.
Yeah.
And the CDC, which is kind of collecting data from all 50 states and the District of Columbia and other territories, is collecting it all, kind of maybe providing an update once a day. And it seems to be consistently behind where at least Wisconsin DHS's data is. And so I'm not sure. I would guess that it's also a little bit behind where other states are tracking their own data. But in terms of comparing the rollouts, I think it's perfectly fair to compare how states are going about their rollout, which groups of people they're prioritizing for vaccines, and why. There's been a lot of debate about that. And then also comparing states' communication plans surrounding their rollout. I know that's been a kind of steady refrain that I've heard, both in just reporting that I've read and in hearing from folks directly, that communication could be better in Wisconsin. We heard just even in the initial weeks, frontline healthcare providers who didn't know how or where to get a vaccine, and they were in the first group of people prioritized to get a vaccine. And we're also hearing later this week in Janesville, the local health system there, Mercy Health, has plans to vaccinate all the teachers and staff who want it in the Janesville school district. And even though that group of people is not technically eligible in the state yet, and Mercy Health essentially blamed poor communication from the state for making that decision. They said that they need to get shots in arms in their community. And basically without clear direction from the state not to do that, they're going to go ahead and vaccinate all those people. So I know that communication has definitely been an issue. And I think that's one area where it's definitely fair to compare. In terms of comparing states using the CDC data, it's pretty fraught. And then we get to the issue with some of these states that you mentioned that have really a higher percentage of people who have been vaccinated so far. So the Dakotas, West Virginia, they're up in like the 5, 6, 7% of their population having been getting their first dose of the vaccine versus Wisconsin, which is about at 3%. And that's more typical of a lot of states, going down to about 2% in Alabama. Those numbers there's a lot of caveats to that too, because the Dakotas and West Virginia, they're small population states.
Yeah.
Arguably, it's
not
potentially
apples to
easier.
Apples.
Yeah, it's not apples to apples at all. So there's a lot of things that can kind of complicate these comparisons.
So
make them not clear cut.
On the issue of communication breakdown, Lyric from Blanchardville called, couldn't stay with us. Lyric is 73 and heard mm-hmm. that vaccines are now available for seniors. But when she calls around, nobody has it. She wants more and better information, more clarity about who has the vaccines and where she should go to get them.
Yeah, yeah. And I think a lot of people, including vaccinators, are interested in getting that information. I believe phase 1B is the phase that the state is currently kind of unrolling
yes.
in its vaccine rollout. And so seniors, so people who are 65 and older will be eligible for the vaccine next Monday. But yesterday during a briefing with the Department of Health Services, a media briefing, the assistant secretary of the department said that folks in that group, I mean, it's a big group, it's about 700,000 people in the state. She recommended that with the understanding that people are very anxious, a lot of people are very anxious to get the vaccine as soon as possible. She recommended having some patience and maybe waiting a week or two before really trying to seek out a dose, just because in these initial days, it's going to be kind of challenging.
That's really contradictory. It's like, you're eligible, you can get it, and yet, wait, just hold off for a second. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's two different messages.
It is. Yeah. And they would say, well, you will be eligible next Monday. You're not eligible yet. But yeah, no, they are kind of sending some mixed messages there. They're also really recommending that folks try to, as much as they can, set up appointments or make inquiries about setting up an appointment online. I think we heard yesterday anecdotally from around the state that vaccinators their phones were just ringing off the hook once it was announced that seniors would be eligible next week for the vaccine. So they're really trying to push people to do that research online as much as possible if you have access to the internet.
We're talking about the nuances of vaccine distribution numbers, what they mean, with Will Cushman from Wisconsin, taking your questions about the data, the vaccine distribution, the rollout, 800-642-1234. So just to clarify here, everyone over age 65 in Wisconsin will be eligible for the COVID vaccine starting on Monday. And state health officials said yesterday it could take a couple of months to vaccinate that age group. Is that timeline realistic based on what you've seen from the rollout so far?
Yeah, we'll see. It sounds like the last couple weeks, about 70,000 doses have been administered roughly every week. And so with this group of people being about 700,000 strong, that's about 10 weeks to get that whole group a first dose, assuming that there will be some people in that group that will not get a vaccine for various reasons. But yeah, so 2.5 months, I think, is kind of optimistic for getting through that group at current levels. And who's to say, hopefully things will ramp up more as the weeks go on, as we get more vaccines and more doses. That's obviously a top priority of the incoming Biden administration. So we'll see if things can kind of speed up a little bit.
So as you're knee deep in data each day, which numbers are you watching most closely?
Ooh, that's a really good question. I am really myself personally curious and just kind of tracking the discrepancies between the CDC and the state in terms of the number of doses that are actually administered. And I would say that's what I'm watching most closely is the number of doses that are administered. And now what's really exciting is the number of people who have completed both doses and are fully vaccinated. As of yesterday in the state, I think that there's about 40,000 people in Wisconsin now who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, which is still a small number compared to our whole population. But I think that's a hopeful sign.
But certainly, too, that we are at the mercy of the doses that are available on hand and that the supply is there, that the supply chain is smooth.
Right. Yeah. And President-elect, soon to be President Biden, has said that he wants to invoke the Defense Production Act to more quickly manufacture vaccine doses and supplies. If that comes to pass, the supply chain will hopefully speed up quite a bit. We'll see.
Will, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Will Cushman is associate editor of WisconText, a collaborative reporting project of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. Just ahead, we learn what's in store for transitioning to a new Biden administration. What do you want to ask about the nuts and bolts of presidential transitions and how they work? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.